We're talking with Kevin Zeese, who's one of the co-directors of Popular Resistance. And along with Margaret Flowers, he recently put out an article, Pivot to Peace Must Replace U.S. Pivot to War with China. Kevin, may I just briefly, what is Popular Resistance?
Popular Resistance is a news site that also is used for organizing. We cover news related to the popular movement, and it came out of the Occupy movement.
Now, President Trump has recently been escalating the war, Cold War with China, partly to deflect attention from his mishandling of the COVID-19 crisis and the collapse of the United States economy. But one of the points that your article makes is that, in fact, this is not something that was started under Trump. In fact, President Obama took a number of steps to escalate the conflict with China.
Yeah, the U.S. has seen China as a rival, a growing rival, especially economically. For more than 5-6 years now, the Chinese GDP measured by purchasing power parity has been larger than the United States, and under the traditional GDP measure, it will soon be larger than the United States. And the U.S. has been trying to hold China down because it's a threat to U.S. domination. So during the Obama era, the Obama administration, with Hillary Clinton doing a major part of the work, writing about how China, Asia is going to be the dominant factor in global economy, and the U.S. needs to be in the center of that. They moved to put in place the Asian pivot. So the Obama-Biden-Clinton team moved 60% of U.S. military resources to Asia, specifically into the China Sea, but to really show China that the U.S. is a power in the Pacific Rim. This has been increased by President Trump. President Trump has been especially escalating recently in this last year, specifically with increases in ships, battleships, and U.S. Air Force flyovers along the China Rim. And most recently with the COVID crisis, he's been escalating the rhetoric about COVID-19 being the China virus and making all sorts of allegations about Chinese secrecy and such. This is leading to a real escalation. The U.S. has changed its national security strategy from the war on terror to great power conflict. That's the official strategy now, great power conflict. It's almost like saying World War III is our strategy. But the most recent escalation by Trump has been seen in budget documents and statements from testimony about those budgets, great escalation of missiles, including smaller missiles that will be traveling on marine boats along the China coast. These are nuclear-tipped missiles. They'll also be land-based missiles. They are also, U.S. is also creating relationships with the Philippines and Japan to create a rim of security that encircles China on the Pacific coast. And this is, they're particularly targeting the islands and the along China that where most of the oil and trade for China goes through. So this would be a choke point to stop both the use of oil and gas for their military and their economy, as well as to stop global trade to China. It's a real effort to put China down. And there have been reports from the Obama era, from the RAND Corporation and others, describing how we win the unthinkable war. How do we defeat China? And those reports called for doing so before 2025, because China was growing its military arsenal in response to the U.S. escalation. And the idea is to put in place the rim of military activity so that China can be bombed back to the Stone Age and really be no longer a rival to the United States. It's a very scary scenario.
Now, one of the things in terms of a military conflict is that you know, I have a sense that a lot of Americans think this idea that we have, I forget the exact number, but military bases in, you know, well over 100 countries is sort of a normal, you know, effort that a major power does. Mm-hmm. But how does sort of, you know, like the United States military presence in other countries compare to China or even Russia in terms of number of, you know, bases they have put, military bases in other countries?
Well, the U.S. has 800 military bases, and if you combine those with outposts, 1,200 military bases and outposts around the world. So we are, throughout the world, our military is having bases. China has no foreign military bases. Russia has two naval bases that go to freshwater ports, so they're not landlocked. And it's a no comparison between the United States. The same is true with military spending. U.S. military spending, which is more than $1 trillion, when you include not just the Pentagon, but the Department of Energy, for example, where all the nuclear weapons are budgeted. More than $1 trillion spending is more than the next 10 countries combined. So Russia spends about 10% of what the U.S. spends on military, so that we dwarf all other countries. And this has been part of an effort by the United States to really create a domination that is both on the land, sea, air, and now in outer space. So it's a very aggressive effort to really have a complete domination, especially over great powers like Russia and China. This is a very risky strategy because Russia and China see this strategy. This is a public strategy. So Russia and China sees this strategy developing, and they're developing a stronger military alliance. And they're also developing alliances with other countries as well. So while Russia and China are doing that in response, they also see the U.S. directing NATO to target Russia and China as part of this great power conflict. And Japan, a major ally in the Pacific Rim, along with the Philippines, are joining with the U.S. So this is a real global conflict. And two things happened in the last week. One was an internal Chinese document, internal intelligence report, that said that as a result of the COVID virus and the backlash, a backlash that the U.S. is helping to foster, China has to be ready for an increased economic war and even a military attack from the United States. And then Reuters did a report looking at this escalation by the United States, showing the increased number of missiles, the increased number of ships. And so you're seeing both the U.S. and China seeing this escalation developing. So this conflict, this new national strategy of great power conflict is becoming a reality.
Now, one of the things that was initiated during the Obama administration, which you and many others were active in successfully stopping, was the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Why was that such a concern?
Well, the TPP was the largest corporate trade agreement in U.S. in world history. It included 11 Pacific Rim countries and the United States, but did not include the largest Pacific Rim country, China. It was an effort by the United States to cut China out of the economies of the Asia-Pacific. And so this was an effort at dollar domination with U.S. corporations and U.S. dollars dominating the Asia-Pacific Rim and really an effort to shut China out as much as possible. We were successful in stopping it, and people thought that was like kind of the beginning of the end of U.S. domination of Asia. But, of course, the United States never gives up. And after that was stopped, the U.S. escalated its new strategy of great power conflict. So we continue on this path. It's a very much a corporate and U.S. foreign policy goal for the U.S. to be the dominator of the Asia Pacific.
So we have been talking with Kevin Zeese, who is co-executive director of Popular Resistance, about a recent article, Pivot to Peace Must Replace United States Pivot to War with China. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. So we continue part two of our conversation with Kevin Zeese of Popular Resistance. A recent article, A Pivot to Peace Must Replace United States pivot to war with China. More recently, Trump has been escalating the conflict with China, allegedly over the COVID-19 crisis, saying, oh, maybe this was manufactured in some lab in China and it got out and China hid how serious a problem it was. And if they had spoken a lot sooner, you know, we wouldn't have so many deaths in the United States. What were some of the responses you had in your article to that line of contention?
Well, you know, the U.S. has actually put forward more than a dozen false claims blaming China, calling China not being transparent, not telling people soon enough, and even claiming falsely that it originated in the Wuhan lab. All this has been disproved. In fact, we mentioned that in the article on our newsletter on popular resistance, but we also have an article on popular resistance that called Reality Check that goes through each of these lies. And this is all part of manufactured consent for escalating the crisis. And the reality is that China told the World Health Organization in December when they first discovered an unusual pneumonia on January 3rd, China contacted the U.S. Center for Disease Control specifically to tell them about this unusual pneumonia and that might be a virus. China put out warnings. That CDC warning was then shared with the Department of Health and Human Services and the National Security Council. So the White House was aware of this on January 3rd. And here we are 5 months later, and the U.S. has still not put in place adequate testing or tracing. Just this week, China found 6 cases of COVID in Wuhan, 6 cases. And they announced that in the next 10 days, they're going to test every resident of Wuhan, a city larger than New York. That means 11 million people will be tested over the next 10 days in order to stamp out this small increase in cases. 6 cases, and they're going to do 11 million tests. The United States, in 5 months, has done 9 million tests. Inadequate. Trump's response has been inadequate from the beginning. It wasn't until mid-March that I finally took any serious action. The one step he took before that was to announce stopping flights from China. But the reality is China had already stopped flights out of Wuhan. So that was an inconsequential action. And we've learned since then that the virus actually came into New York through Europe, not through China. And so Trump has mishandled this virus terribly. The U.S. now has 1/4 of all the deaths from this virus in the world. 80,000 deaths. We'll have more than 100,000 deaths by the end of this month. Unless we make some major changes, we'll be in the multiple hundreds of thousands of deaths by the fall in the midst of the presidential. So Trump is panicking. He's panicking because he knows that people will see how he mishandled this test, this virus, calling it a hoax, saying it'll be gone by April, saying the maximum deaths will be 60,000. On and on and on, he's made full inaccurate statements. So rather than accept responsibility, every time he's asked, do you accept any responsibility? He says, no, I don't accept any responsibility. He instead is looking for a scapegoat, and that scapegoat is China. Now, China is a great scapegoat because since the Obama era, there's been a bipartisan effort to attack China. So a lot of false information about China has been put into U.S. press. The Hong Kong protests, which had been funded by the National Endowment for Democracy, the anti-China movement since the 1990s. The U.S. has been funding that. And so these anti-China protests that were pretending to be democracy protests were misreporting the United States. The allegations regarding the Uyghurs in the Muslim territory, another great exaggeration. Again, the U.S. has been funding the Uyghur Congress in that part of China for more than a decade. So the U.S. has been fomenting problems in China and reporting them in the U.S. media to create an anti-China bias. So, of course, now you see Biden and Trump both trying to out-attack China each other. Biden saying Trump is weak, Trump saying Biden is weak. They're both wrong. We need to find the time. We need to move toward cooperation with China. We have global crisis issues, the pandemic, the global economic collapse, nuclear arms race, and of course, most important, the climate crisis. We need to unite together with China and other countries to confront these global issues. Instead of sowing division with anti-China falsehoods, we should be finding ways to de-escalate and work together and solve these common crises.
Now, at the end of your article, you point to a page, a petition, I believe called Pivot to Peace, right, which sounds, you know, very similar to what you've just been talking about. Can you explain, you know, how has that arisen, and is that just the United States effort, or more countries involved?
It's a global effort, and the Pivot to Peace began in the United States as Chinese groups were under attack. They started to form this, and now it's broadened out to other organizations and other people. Pivot to Peace is something people can all go to. On the website, in addition to the petition, there's information about the escalation of conflict between the U.S. and China and how we have to de-escalate it. I think this is really something that, as we saw the pivot to war that started with the Obama administration and that now has turned into a national security strategy of great power conflict, it's essential for people in the United States to tell our country we want to see de-escalation and cooperation between the U.S. and China. These are the two largest economies in the world. If we're in conflict, it hurts the economic security and the military security of the world. We need to find a way to come together, work together to solve the common crises of climate change, nuclear escalation, the pandemic, and the global economic collapse, which is looking more and more like it could become a global depression. Because in addition to mishandling the virus, the Trump administration and Congress are mishandling the response to this economic collapse.
So we're talking with Kevin Zeitzer, about 3 minutes left. I'm sort of curious about how other, you know, countries in Asia and Pacific view, you know, China and its growing, you know, economic might. Certainly one of the things, at least in the Western press, has been pointed out, China's been quite aggressive about lending money to smaller countries to support development projects, but it gives them, you know, increased leverage over, you know, that country. Are other Asian countries concerned about the growing power of China?
Well, it's, you know, that's an interesting question, because the U.S., of course, tries to foment division between other countries with China, particularly Vietnam, Philippines. And of course, there's longstanding problems between Taiwan and China, as China sees that Taiwan is actually, from their perspective, part of China and needs to become unified more closely with China. So there are conflicts. But the more important point, I think, about China is they are developing the Belt and Road Initiative, which goes through Asia, the Middle East, Russia, Northern Africa, and Europe. And connecting Europe to Asia through that Belt and Road Initiative will be the engine of economic development for this century. As part of that effort, the Belt and Road Health effort in response to the COVID virus, China has been providing assistance to many European countries and Middle Eastern countries like Iran, and has been working to try to help countries to respond to the virus. China has shown a one way to respond to the virus effectively, and it's one that we could learn a great deal from. But they have been sending doctors, health supplies, not only to the Belt and Road Initiative countries, but even to the United States. They've been sending supplies. So they have been trying very hard to help countries respond to this terrible pandemic. But the Belt and Road Initiative is something that will be a key to the engine of the economy for the future. And it really threatens the United States, because what it means is a European and Asian dominated 21st century with the United States cut out. The United States, instead of causing division, needs to figure out how to unify with China so it can join in building a green economy through the Belt and Road Initiative. That is a step that needs to be taken. Conflict will not help either China, U.S., Russia, or Europe.
So we've been talking with Kevin Zeitzer of PopularResistance.org. I know you have a daily newsletter people can sign up for, I assume, through PopularResistance.org.
That's right. On the front page of PopularResistance.org, you can see both our weekly and our daily news digest. The news digest, neither one of these have any charge. The article we've been talking about is our weekly newsletter. The daily news digest summarizes about 15 articles a day in 4 or 5 lines. You can then click on the article and get the full article. And we urge people not only to get the daily digest, but also when you see articles you agree with or are interested to you, share them widely. We have to be the media. the people's media needs to become much more powerful. We consciously work, like you're doing with your with this kind of your radio station. If we consciously work to be the media, we can overcome the misinformation of the corporate media and the bipartisan Wall Street parties in Washington, D.C. So sign up at the Daily Digest and our weekly newsletter and share the information widely.
Thank you, Kevin Zeese, popularresistance.org. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.